Okay. Any questions or issues? All right. As I said yesterday, I wanted to finish off with the last of the Paul's graph cases before we move on to chapter 3. Before we do this last Harris case, I want to comment on some notes that are on page 70, 2-70, and to emphasize the first of the notes here about the difference between the doctrine of what's sometimes called the eggshell plaintiff or the thin-skulled plaintiff as compared to the idea of an unforeseeable plaintiff. And they appear similar in this respect, that in both cases you have a very unlikely event or a very unexpected result. In the classic case of Vosburgh versus Putney, the plaintiff is kicked in the shins and winds up, in effect, having his leg fall off, which is very unusual. And you might think that, like the doctrine of Paul's graph, you would limit the defendant's liability to what was reasonably foreseeable. But that's not the case. The principle or the maxim of the law that applies in cases like that is in for a penny, in for a pound, or you take the victim as you find him or her. And what is the distinction, or what's the difference? How do we know when Paul's graph serves as a limitation on liability and when the defendant is liable without regard to whether it's foreseeable or not? And the answer lies in whether we're talking about the extent of injury. If that's the case, where the defendant acknowledges, well, I could have expected a modest amount of injury from a kick in the shins, but no one would have foreseen that that would lead to such a catastrophic injury. If we're only talking about the extent of injury, foreseeability is no defense. Again, in for a penny, in for a pound. By contrast, where the defendant denies the foreseeability of any injury at all, where it is not just an unforeseeable scope of injury, it is the plaintiff herself who is unforeseeable, where the defendant says, from where I was sitting or standing, I could not reasonably foresee an injury of any kind to Mrs. Paul's graph. It's at that point where we say the doctrine of limitation applies, where if you're Cardozo, you can limit the scope of liability to the zone of danger. Or if you're Andrews, you can say that liability doesn't attach to things not proximately caused by the defendant's negligence. But the law doesn't permit a defendant to limit the scope of liability, the extent of liability, based on what the defendant may convince us was the ordinary extent to which injury would be foreseeable. So that's the first thing I wanted to comment on, so that you had some sense of how they were distinguished. And the second point is note number 3. I think I mentioned this yesterday. The difference between saying that the mechanism of the injury was not foreseeable, but that doesn't matter so long as some degree of danger was foreseeable. So again, in the case in Note 3, the United Novelty case, the plaintiff is using gasoline to clean this machine, and the injury occurs because a rat jumps, the rat runs through the furnace, his fur catches on fire, it ignites the gasoline, and we then have a fire. The point is, not that I would foresee a flaming rat running across my path, but rather that I could foresee some method of ignition from using gasoline, and therefore it would be negligent. Okay, now I think we're ready for the final case here, Harris versus R.A. Martin, Inc. Can somebody tell us about Harris? Ms. McLaughlin. Okay, so the what's the pulse graph issue in the case? Mm-hmm. So the defendant puts these concrete blocks into the dumpster, and the dumpster then tips over onto the plaintiff. And so what's the defendant's argument? Okay. And again, what did the trial court say in response to that argument? Yeah, the trial court agreed with the defendant that the defendant did not owe a duty of care to the plaintiff. Now, if you characterize the defendant's conduct as negligent, toward whom would it be negligent? Okay. Maybe the people you're expecting would be the folks who unloaded the dumpster, or the people at the landfill, or something like that. And so the notion here is that the plaintiff is like Mrs. Paul's graph, who would have thunk it that negligently stacking these heavy blocks of concrete into the dumpsters such that it would tip over, who would ever have guessed that somebody like the plaintiff would get hurt by that conduct? Now, it doesn't really compute in a classic kind of Paul's graph case. If, for example, you had somebody putting something in a dumpster and, let's say, the dumpster is being transported down the interstate highway and the dumpster comes apart and, I don't know, I'm just trying to make something up. You could imagine a much more unusual Rube Goldberg kind of Kinsman transit. It gets away into an unexpected, unusual kind of predicament, but this isn't it. This seems like exactly the kind of thing that you would be worried about if, in fact, the idea is a construction company that's using the dumpster to get rid of construction materials. You'd think they ought to use reasonable care because of people around the dumpster, wouldn't you? Well, I think you could easily have difficulty if that's not a contradiction. It would make sense if someone says, I don't see the connection between the statute and this particular injury, that the, you know, it's like Gorse versus Scott. Maybe it's a good idea to have pens when you're transporting sheep on across the English Channel, but it's not, you know, the statute wasn't for that purpose. The statute reflects a different kind of purpose. So trying to use the statute to get you to the point of finding negligence doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But if you're not relying on the statute per se, but you're simply saying that a reasonable person, knowing the mechanics and the, you know, whatever it would be, the nature of dumpsters and the nature stuff you're putting into it, a reasonable person would recognize putting these things in could pose a hazard to the folks who are working around them. McAmena? Well, except that, remember, to the extent that the ordinance is a revenue-producing ordinance, it's not designed for the safety of people who work around dumpsters. It's designed to make sure that people are paying their fair share of the landfill cost. To that extent, the ordinance, again, is a poor tool to say these people were careless. They're in violation of the law, but the purpose of the law is a different, has a different angle. But that isn't to say that there isn't an independent basis, leaving the statute aside, to say a reasonable person wouldn't take heavy concrete blocks, put them in the top of the dumpster, knowing that the people who empty dumpsters could have these things come crashing down on them. Brown? Well, and I always include, or when we're in the middle of this case, as we are now, I say to myself, why did I stick this case in? Because it's counterintuitive. Just when you think you understand it, I must be missing something here. And I would like to present a more comforting, consistent presentation of the law, but one of the reasons I leave it in is that it demonstrates that the law doesn't always follow a nice, neat, straight line. Not only does the trial judge get this wrong, from my perspective, but even when the appellate court gets it right, from my perspective, and here I'm agreeing with you, that the Paul's Graph argument doesn't really seem to fit very well here, we still get a dissenting judge who thinks Paul's Graph does apply. So it's partly my way of suggesting to you that one of the things that you wind up doing as a lawyer is not only making assessments of what you think are the most persuasive arguments, but you also spend some time thinking about what somebody might argue, even though you think it's a dumb argument. Now, that's, as I say, it's dangerous, and the moment I do that, I feel as though I'm inviting you on an exam to give me a whole bunch of dumb arguments, saying, well, this is a dumb argument, but somebody might argue it. And that's always a little bit perilous. But the flip side of that, the way you can make a mistake in the other direction is that you have such a high standard of what qualifies as a reasonable argument that you narrow your focus down to the ones that pass your very high standards. And in many cases, it's better to acknowledge the fact, well, somebody's going to make the argument that blah, blah, blah. Now, I think that's wrong, but somebody might make that argument. Or even, we might even see if we could make this argument. I don't particularly like it. It's beneath my standards. But before I throw it out, maybe I should think about, maybe if I played with this long enough, I could come up with a way in which it isn't such a dumb argument. So, again, I give it to you with some trepidation, and yet it's a good reminder to all of us that that as successful as we may be in unifying the law into a nice, neat package, occasionally it doesn't turn out that way. The trial judge you're appearing in front of may not be as bright as you are in seeing how all this stuff fits together. And better that you be prepared for him or her to take a wrong turn like that than that you assume, oh, I'm sure he wouldn't be so stupid as to say something like this. Well, maybe we shouldn't be so quick to reach that conclusion. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. You may wind up with a dissenting judge like this, you know, somebody like the trial judge or like the dissenting judge, who has it in his or her mind, this is my call, I have to decide whether a duty of care extends to this plaintiff, and I say it doesn't, and I dismiss this plaintiff's claim on summary judgment. Now, you can think, once I get to the Court of Appeals and I have people with a more rational viewpoint, I'll get that turned around. But again, it is better for you to have anticipated that the defendant might make this argument. I don't think it ought to be persuasive for the following reasons, but at least I've inventoried that rather than telling my client, oh, don't worry, there's no Paul's graph issue here. And lo and behold, the trial judge dismisses my client's claim. I mean, I can say, oh, that trial judge is crazy. Don't worry, we'll get it reversed on appeal. But then, you know, my heart's going thumpity-thump-thump, saying, am I missing something? How sure am I that the Court of Appeals is going to reverse this? And I would feel I'll sleep a whole lot easier if I've at least told my client, somebody might raise this issue. I don't think it's going anywhere, but at least I've talked about it rather than have the case get decided on an issue I haven't even raised. Ms. McLaughlin? I would think so. Yeah, again, the question is, even from Cardozo's standpoint, is much more defendant-friendly, really. The question is, what would the eye of reasonable vigilance perceive to be the orbit of danger? And if you're depositing, you know, concrete blocks except for gravity, but something like sulfuric acid, gee, I put that in a dumpster, even something less toxic, but a huge vat of vegetable oil, you know, and it turns out the vegetable oil is, you know, wanted by animals or something, you know, strange things happen, and spontaneous combustion or whatever it is, and lo and behold, that stuff turns out to cause some kind of other harm. The even from Cardozo's perspective, when you press the pause button before the stuff is going in the dumpster and you ask yourself the question, well, what bad thing could happen from this? If the eye of reasonable vigilance could foresee different scenarios in which this could turn out to be a hazard, then Cardozo would say, to that extent, a duty of care attaches. Now, reasonable people could differ about that, but it doesn't seem like that big of a leap when you're putting stuff in a dumpster. And therefore, again, I found this kind of surprising in terms of at least its initial outcome. It turns out well in the end, but it's a lot closer call than one might have thought from a purely theoretical standpoint. It also illustrates the way in which, quite frankly, these are difficult concepts, and even judges who are theoretically on the bench because of their superior judicial legal ability, even they have a tough time getting these to come out right. Viviana? You're troubled by the majorities. Yes. But what's one of the major features of Andrew's way of framing the issue? And who is the decision maker for Andrews? Yes, it's a practical, fact-based judgment left to the jury, as distinguished from Cardozo's idea that it's a question about law, which is for the judge. So in that respect, again, even if, and I can't remember whether this jurisdiction claims to rely upon Paul's graph, So, again, whether the jurisdiction nominally or theoretically is a Cardozo-type jurisdiction, but in fact the judges wind up leaning more toward an Andrews approach, particularly with respect to the decision-maker, that it's a question of fact for the jury. Again, this is the kind of thing where, for purposes of an exam, or even if you lived in the state of West Virginia, and you had read the cases in West Virginia, and you thought you knew the law as the dissenting judge describes it, it turns out that a majority of the court is, in effect, an Andrews court. So this is, again, what makes your life as a lawyer challenging, that what you think you know can get you into trouble, because if you assured your client, oh, this is a Cardozo jurisdiction, it's going to be a question of law for the judge, lo and behold, a bunch of judges don't see it that way. So, again, I think you help yourself as a lawyer by being somewhat more circumspect about claiming to know what you claim you know, and erring on the side of saying, this is my impression of what Cardozo would say about this problem, and as I understand it, West Virginia follows Cardozo's approach. Therefore, I would be reasonably confident of this outcome is a better way to do it than say, according to Cardozo, blah, 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 Paul's graph is the law in this jurisdiction, therefore would have this outcome. You're doing your client a disservice in that sense by claiming to know what it turns out you don't really know. And it may be that the judges in the West Virginia Court of Appeals are stupid, But in the end, what your client is interested in is not that you have the better of the argument judged on debating points. Your client wants to know, when you tell me this, can I, in effect, take that to the bank? Is this something, when you say it's going to happen, it's really going to happen, or is this more like a weather forecast of saying, it looks like it's going to be 80 degrees tomorrow, but we all know that that's subject to a fairly significant margin of error. It's only a forecast. It's not really a statement of some kind of definite certainty. Okay, any other questions about Paul's graph, foreseeability, chapter 2? I want to spend a few minutes kind of seeing if I can wrap up chapter 2 before we move on to chapter 3. But any loose ends here? Okay, I want to kind of take us back to where we started with chapter 2. I feel a little bit like the description of the, I believe it's an expression in Zen Buddhism, of the student who, in the process of learning the meditation technique, says, well, first there were mountains, then there were no mountains, and then there were mountains again. That you go through a period of time when none of it makes sense, and then you come out of it at a point where you've kind of put the thing back together again. You start out with a somewhat naive, I would say. We all start out with a somewhat naive notion of causation, that causation is something kind of intuitive. We're making judgments all the time about what things cause other things. And we don't pause to kind of pull them apart analytically. Through chapter 2, we've done that process of pulling things apart analytically, but now I sort of want to put them back together again, that sometimes it's as simple and intuitive as your pre-law school notions of this. That is, as I've said before, many cases, in fact, most tort cases, I would say, do not involve complex questions of causation. They are more like the running a red light case or a medical malpractice case where if you prove that the defendant was negligent, that's the ball game. That leads to liability, and there is no difficulty showing the connection between failing to stop at the light versus trying to get through the intersection and hitting somebody in the middle of the intersection. It's really quite clear that the defendant's negligence caused the collision, assuming we can show that it in fact was negligent. But there are some cases, and it turns out I disproportionately represent those cases in the exam to test your knowledge of how to deal with them. So you get a sort of uncharacteristic sample of the world of tort cases where there are problems with causation, and of two varieties, as we've seen. One variety has to do with but-for causation, where there's a difficulty establishing the factual scientific historical connection between the defendant's conduct and the plaintiff's injury. We just don't know whether the defendant's negligence or for that matter, strict liability conduct was a cause, in fact, of the plaintiff's injury. And so we have various doctrines to deal with such things as unknown identity or loss of a chance or multiple redundant causes, so forth, where we're struggling with the question, who done it, in effect? Or he said, she said. Did this thing lead to that or did it not? It's a factual scientific dispute that we're having. By contrast, the second group of cases in the legal cause section is not related to the facts so much as it is related to judgment. What do you think makes sense or is fair? Should people who sell hunting rifles to drunk customers have to pay for the injuries caused when those drunken customers go out and do bad things with their hunting rifles? Is that good public policy or not? In making that judgment, you're not, again, at a loss to figure out what happened. You're trying to make the normative, evaluative judgment about what we think should be the rule in our society. So under the doctrine of superseding cause, or the argument of an unforeseeable plaintiff, or the idea of mere chance, we're imposing limits on liability based upon some public policy argument about, again, a normative evaluative judgment about what's fair. And if you have that sort of mental framework for dealing with these problems, I think as you pick your way through exam questions, you'll at least be able to categorize them correctly and say, okay, here's a place where market share liability might be helpful. Or here's a place where the plaintiff might want to argue loss of a chance. Or here's where the defendant will say there's no liability because of a superseding cause. And if you can correctly identify where those arguments are going to kick in, where it's likely that this will show up as a point of contention, then you'll be doing well in terms of organizing your answer and having the basis of a good analysis. So that's my hope for Chapter 2. Then let's take a look in general at Chapter 3. Again, I'm sort of flying over this at 30,000 feet here, giving you a wide-angle perspective before we start plunging into the details. Chapter 3 is, in some ways, you may find yourself feeling that cases in Chapter 3 are a regression back to Chapter 1 or even Chapter 2. That is, we wind up talking about the limits of liability, about whether the defendant owes a duty of care to this particular plaintiff. And in that sense, you're thinking, well, why is there a separate chapter for this? Why didn't we get this material earlier when we were looking at other cases defining the scope of liability? And the reason that they fall into Chapter 3 is because it has to do with the nature of the damages that are claimed. So that if the damages were different, we wouldn't be having this problem. For example, one of the cases early in the chapter has to do with a lady who's on a train and a bunch of drunk guys are allowed to get on the train, and there's kind of scuffling, and they lose their balance and land on her. She's not physically hurt, but she's really grossed out. And she wants to recover damages for this. And so the question is, well, if a button on one of the one of these drunk guys' coats had drawn blood, you know, had scratched her cheek and drawn blood, no one would have any question about the liability of the railroad for that kind of injury. But if it's just emotional loss, we're not interested. How do we identify the dividing line between the types of damages that are acceptable and those that aren't? Or similarly, there's the case of Mrs. Johnson later on, who Mrs. Johnson's daughter gets a telegram saying that her mother's died, and so she makes arrangements for the funeral, and they're having the wake before the funeral, and she looks into the casket and says, "That's not my mother." And it turns out it isn't. It's a different Mrs. Johnson, and her mother is still alive in a state hospital in New York, and this Mrs. Johnson is in the casket. We need to contact her family to let her know what's going on. Now, she too, the daughter of the real Mrs. Johnson, wants damages for the negligence of the state hospital in not checking to make sure they had the right Emma Johnson's relatives notified about this death. Does she get a recovery? Again, if there are limits to the recovery of damages because of the nature of the damages, we need to talk about what those rules are. Now, the way I've structured the chapter is that the first section, it's divided into three parts, like Gaul divided into three parts. The first part of chapter three does kind of an inventory of the types of damages. So we look at property damage, wage loss and medical expenses, economic loss. We look at emotional injury, pain and suffering, mental anguish, and so forth. We look at punitive damages. We look at attorney's fees. And we ask the question, well, what's the status of each of these kinds of damage? How are they regarded by the law in terms of the presumption that the plaintiff can or can't recover damages like these? And it's also useful to categorize them because in other areas of tort law, distinctions are made based on the type of damage. So, for example, in a wrongful death statute, you may distinguish between recovery of economic loss and the recovery of grief or emotional loss. Similarly, in terms of Chapter 6 in joint and several liability, you may say this rule applies to economic damages, but a different rule applies to non-economic damage. So again, we'll at least have an inventory, a categorization scheme to identify them. The middle part of Chapter 3 is a sort of a who question. Obviously, the immediate victim of the defendant's negligence is entitled to a recovery, but what about parties related to that victim? So, for example, in a wrongful death case, we can't give an award to the victim, to the decedent. They're beyond our ability to compensate. So we turn to other potential beneficiaries. And so wrongful death turns out to be a complicated area, not so much of, or in addition to determining whether the defendant caused the harm and the defendant's conduct was a breach of duty toward that decedent, but who gets the recovery and how much is it going to be? How do we measure the loss? Even when the victim hasn't died, there may be people other than the immediate victim who make a claim for compensation. So in the Rodriguez case, the defendant drops a 600-pound pipe on Marianne Rodriguez's husband. He survives, but he's very badly injured. And Marianne Rodriguez says, you dropped a 600-pound pipe on our marriage, and I'm part of that marriage, and therefore I get to recover the damages that fall to me, in addition to whatever my husband is entitled to for the injury that you caused to him. Does she have standing, in effect, to make a claim for her own damages? What about the parents of a child who's injured or the children of parents who are injured? Should we extend the right to compensation to people aside from the immediate victim? What happens if you have a recovery that's historically available to spouses, but you have non-spousal kinds of relationships? What's the law's attitude toward those? How do you decide which relationships count? And notice on these points that it's very important to identify, kind of in the Paul's graph way, Are these questions of law for the judge? Is that the party who will, or the entity performing the gatekeeping function of deciding what qualifies and what doesn't? Or should these questions essentially be left up to a jury? So that we all line up at the cashier's window, sort of, I'm trying to remember who the defensive back was, whose philosophy of defense was, I just tackle everybody until I find the guy with the ball. Was that Deacon Jones? I think that was who it was. That was his philosophy of playing defense. So, you know, you could have that same attitude about the claimants to compensation. You know, essentially send everybody in front of the jury, and the jury can figure out which ones don't deserve compensation, and everybody else gets some. So, again, the middle part of Chapter 3 is, in addition to the immediate victim, who else gets to recover? The final part of Chapter 3 would be, in effect, the kind of detail work or tweaking the amount. Let's assume we're going to make an award. We know who it's going to. How do we begin to particularize the amount of the award? How do we know when an award is too much? How do we know whether to include compensation from other sources? How do we deal with things like tort reform that may place limits on how much somebody can recover, caps on recovery? How do we control the kind of argument that plaintiff's lawyers make to a jury when they invite the jury to send a message through their verdict about what the defendant was doing? What happens if the plaintiff is very skillful in doing what's called a day in the life of the plaintiff, where you portray what the plaintiff has to put up with because of the injury? Maybe it's a disfigured appearance, or the inability to use their limbs, or some other aspect of life that the plaintiff wants to make vivid to the jury. What degree of specificity or what degree of graphicness will we permit the plaintiff's lawyer to present? When are we getting too emotional, or when is emotion exactly what we should be doing? So again, these questions that show up in the third part of Chapter 3 have to do with essentially refining the amount of the award. Now, looking again in sort of a global way, as this first little snippet on the bottom of page 1 and the top of page 2 from Professor Jaffe, he acknowledges the kind of poor stepchild relationship that damages questions have, that liability dominates the theoretical apparatus of tort law. But in fact, damages questions are extremely important. From a practicing lawyer's standpoint, there's a limit to how accurate you can be in terms of projecting the likelihood of liability. And before you try to say, well, there's a 62.3% chance of imposing liability, you should begin to at least pay some attention to liability for what? What's this case worth? Assuming we could impose liability, are we talking about a $20,000 case, a $2,000 case, a $2 million case? What's this case worth? What's the likely range of damages? What will count? What's a jury likely to award? Now, that's a very difficult number to come up with, But better to make some educated guess about that than to treat it as though it were a completely unknowable number. So to the extent that these questions help a lawyer get a sense of what the case is worth, that is helpful in terms of figuring out what should I be looking for in terms of a settlement. If I'm the plaintiff, what can I expect this case to generate? If I'm the defendant, how scared should I be? At what point should I figure it's better to get out my checkbook and write a check, even a large one, than it is to risk a case like this? Or can I be reasonably certain that even if liability is imposed, the damages are going to be in a range that wouldn't be the end of the world if I had to pay that? It's not worth paying a whole lot of money in settlement where I'm not really that worried about having liability imposed. So, again, I hope that as we study these damages cases, you get a better sense of being able to look at a case and saying to yourself, well, I have an idea what this case is worth. It's a big ticket item. It's a small ticket item. Not only can I evaluate liability, but I at least have a place to start in terms of assessing what the damages are going to look like. Okay. I only have a few more minutes. I'd just like to get us started with McDaniel versus Linder. And essentially, I don't spend a whole lot of time on property damage because the principles are relatively clear. The principle in a property damage case, or the rule, is that you look at the fair market value of the property before the accident, the fair market value of the property after the accident, and the difference is the compensable damage. Many of you have already been through this when you've been in an automobile collision of some kind and you had to collect from the insurance company. And the insurance company would say, well, the fair market value of your car before the accident was, according to the Blue Book, a 1989 Honda Civic with 143,000 miles on it, is worth $3,600 or whatever they say it's worth. And after the accident, it had salvage value because it had pretty good, you know, parts of various kinds. You could get a salvage value that was $500. So I'll give you $3,100 for your car. And in many cases, I'm sure you said that's not nearly enough. I had that car in primo shape. I just had the valves reground. You know, it was running like a top. I got 43 miles to the gallon. You know, it was a great car. I wouldn't have sold that. I had an offer the week before. You know, somebody, Mr. Johnson. Well, in that case, the cost of repair is relevant to the extent that if through the spending the money on the repair, I can restore it to a value that's a smaller differential, then it's worth it to repair. But oftentimes what the adjuster will say is, I'm totaling your car. The cost to repair, it's, you know, I took it to the body shop, they said it's $4,300 to repair this thing. Hey, the Blue Book says it was only worth $3,600. And it's got a salvage value of $500. I'll give you a check for $3,100. You interested? And so that's the basis upon which property damages are typically assessed. And you can fight over them. I'm sure many of you have fought over them. But the legal principle is one that's relatively clear. It's when we start with the next section where the wheels come off, because suddenly figuring out how much we need to pay Mrs. O'Shea because she can't cook on a riverboat anymore, that's a really tough question, as it turns out. I should say, for example, you don't have to bring a slide rule to the exam. This isn't about number crunching. Posner wants to make sure you know how smart he is. And he is a smart guy, I'll give him that. But But what I want you to do is just understand the kind of general methodology here. No one's going to have to be crunching numbers or talking about discounting future value to present value, but we'll start on that on Monday.